And now on Books Plus, two provocative writers who tell international stories of migration, refugees, conflict and pain that zing with energy, anger and the rhythms of unconventional speech. Maxine Beneva-Clark and Ali Alizadeh joined me on stage at the recent Sydney Writers' Festival in a session called Speaking Out. And yes, they were happy to be outspoken, which means that there may be one or two examples of strong language, should that bother you. Let's head into the room to see what they have to say.
Hello and welcome to this Speaking Out session here at the Sydney Writers' Festival and on ABC RN. I'm Kate Evans, joined today by novelist, poet, memoirist and provocateur Maxine Beneva-Clark, whose latest book is Foreign Soil, and essayist, novelist, poet and provocateur Ali Alizadeh, whose latest book is Transactions. Now, welcome to you both. And given that this is a session about speaking out and giving voice, I don't want to be the one to label either of you as speaking or writing from any particular position. The way you choose to define yourself is more interesting, I think. So, Maxine, how do you like to describe yourself as a writer?
I say I'm an Australian writer of Afro-Caribbean descent. You know, I think it's kind of really important as a writer of colour to kind of, I guess, flag that you are a writer of colour, particularly when you're submitting things. And so, that's my preferred description.
And Ali, how do you like to describe yourself?
I think writer, just that. But I guess I like philosophy, so philosophical writer. I've been called a political writer as a term of abuse because artists aren't meant to be political. But I kind of grew to like it now. I'm disliking it again because I don't like politicians too much.
Yeah. Well, let's return then to the writing for both of you. And you both choose to use a range of voices and experiences in a series of sort of episodes, I guess. Ali, the connection between the characters and incidents in your book is more explicit than in Maxine's. What were you wanting to do?
Well, it's a long narrative, so I guess it's a kind of a novel, but I wanted to sort of look at how everything is interconnected. My theory is that, you know, with the end of the Cold War and the great thing called globalization, exploitation didn't end. I think capitalism now is more ruthless than it's ever been. And I think the chains of exchange and exploitation are much more intensified now. So I wanted to show that, how one person produces a commodity, but they get ripped off in the process, another person uses it, and we all use each other. So it's an interconnected sort of landscape of terror and exploitation with loss of sex and violence. It's actually quite entertaining, I think. But also, I kind of thought, how do I do this? And I used the pattern of the tarot cards, the major arcana of the tarot deck, to show the connections, because those cards are connected. You know, there's a narrative from the fool to the world. And I wanted to show that sort of interconnectedness of evil and beauty.
And you do it by using a range of very different voices. So can you give us a taste of that by giving us a short reading and explaining what you're going to read from, what we need to know as we listen to it?
Sure. So these characters kind of cross paths all over the world. This is Amsterdam, for some reason, emerged as a central place in the story, but just because it's such a global city, I guess, but because I'm quite fond of it as well. So I have these characters who live next to each other, basically, and they're neighbours with very different stories, but they cross paths later again in some form. One of them is this guy, and then we'll meet his neighbour later on in our discussion today. But this is the card, which is the hermit. So each story is named after a card. I use the imagery of the card, but the hermit. Stupid people. How could they find this humorous? Does he understand what I've been through? The summer of love. Idiot. They should get on with processing my application instead of coming around asking moronic questions and making jokes about my date of birth. Does he have any idea how we were suffering in Iran in 1969 under the evil Shah, when the hippies in the West were enjoying free love? I shouldn't have let them into my apartment. The idiot case manager says I'm lucky to have been given accommodation while my application is being processed. Most other asylum seekers end up in detention centers. But I'd feel a lot luckier if these ignorant people would just let me be instead of coming here every few days to ask more questions. They know what I've been through. I've told them everything about the prison, about the guards, about the torture. Why do they keep bringing me more forms to fill? Don't they have anything better to do? They say I've been very lucky to be allowed to live freely in Amsterdam without a refugee visa. But I hate this city. I hate everything about it. The first day I ventured out of my apartment, I caught a train, but when I sat down, an officer told me that I had to move to a different part of the carriage because I didn't have a first-class ticket. So I had to stand up in a very busy section while there were empty seats in the first-class section. Stupid, elitist people. Then I had to line up for hours to get to see ugly paintings by some idiot who cut off his own ear and killed himself. Then I had to get a tram back to my apartment. I hate trams. So slow, I felt claustrophobic. And when I arrived, I saw my neighbour, a young woman from Russia or Poland or somewhere, in a very short skirt and smudged makeup, crying as she was fumbling with the keys to open her door. She must be a damn prostitute. I don't linger in their stairway anymore. I hate leaving my flat. I hate answering phones too. It's usually some idiot immigration officer interrogating me about my job back in Iran, about why I was in the Evin prison, things I don't want to talk about to these people. I go out once a week to buy bread and eggs and cans of soup. I'm happy with the mattress they've given me. I don't want anything else. I just want them to leave me alone. Give me back my damn passport and let me forget about everything. So what if I was born in the same year as the Woodstock Festival? How is that supposed to be funny? Was the idiot trying to make friends with me? I don't need friends. I won't make friends. I want to be left alone.
Now, Maxine, in foreign soil, we also get a range of voices, and you have a tendency to lure us in with one scenario and then hit us hard with a twist at the end of it. So what are you going to read for us?
I might read from a story called Harlem Jones, which is a story set at the time of the 2011 Tottenham riots. And it's just about really what happens to a young black British kid on the afternoon of the riots and leading up to him being involved in the riots. You have to excuse the swearing. Harlem legs it from the job shop soon as the sour bitch pushes the button for security. Shoots like the fucking wind. She won't call the coppers, he's sure of it. The old cow's just trying to give him a scare, as if he'd been serious anyway about that shit. Harlem rockets onto Tucker Street and takes the back laneway through the park, long legs striding out on the cracked concrete path. His still new black work shoes strain at the seams, creaking at each push off the pavement. Usually Harlem's mind goes blank when he runs. Only thing he can hear is his own even breathing, wind rushing past his ears. This afternoon is different. As he sprints away from the place, all he can think about is that fucking Mark Duggan. It's the mugshot from the paper that rises up in front of him. Not a real mugshot, but practically. The hard eyes, angry frown. The papers always drag out photos like that when London Met bullets get lodged in some poor black bastard. Harlem pushes the man's face from his mind. He's not Duggan, the pigs won't catch him. He's more fucking Linford Christie. Harlem reaches the Finsbury Park flats in less than 5 minutes, four even, not the slightest bit out of breath. The only reason they kept him on so long at school is because he runs cross country like Wile E. Coyote on crack. Even his running hadn't been enough for them to keep him on, but in the end, Harlem opens the door to the flat and dumps his rucksack in the hallway. He showers and dresses again, leaving his sweaty Tesco's uniform in a heap on the bathroom floor. The kitchen still smells like that disgusting yellow porridge his ma cooks in the mornings. Harlem opens the fridge, starts digging into the jerked chicken and sweet potato left over from last night's dinner, devours it cold, he's that fucking starving, the whole container of it gone. When his ma comes back from a shift down the youth centre, she'll make some more. Harlem raises his right arm, aims the empty plastic container across at the sink. And the crowd goes wild. Harlem Jones has the ball and he shoots. The ball's going in. I don't believe it. It's going in. It's a score. It's a basket. Harlem Jones has won the game. Head thrown back, arms overhead. He runs mad circles on the small square of scuffed linoleum. After filling his rucksack with the spray paint cans hidden on top of the fridge, Harlem shrugs on his new hoodie and opens the front door. Harlem Jones, the tall copper says, his knuckle poised to knock.
You're both poets as well as prose writers, and you both use a range of voices and patois and accent and so on. Do you write your prose imagining it always being read aloud?
I think I do. I do a lot of my writing through a voice recognition program called Dragon. So you dictate and then the writing kind of appears on the page. As you can imagine, there's a lot of editing after that process. But I feel like my primary kind of the way I came to writing is as an oral storyteller. And I always try to kind of write in that way that you can kind of imagine being told this story by somebody.
And what about for you, Ali?
No, I mean, I'm not a... I don't see poetry necessarily as an oral medium. I actually... And, you know, these are the conversations that are being had in the sort of... amongst poets. But I think it's a written thing. I mean, for me, the big diversion as a fiction writer, which is what I'm doing here, is using elements of fiction, especially character. Something that, as a poet, I can't really do. Poetry is, you know, for better or worse, it's pretty much limited to the voice of the speaker. Well, that's the perception of the reader anyway. I've written poems that are utterly fictional, have nothing to do with me, and people have thought they're autobiographical, and that's quite frustrating. So as a fiction writer, I can actually. One of the things I love doing is writing in the voice of women, prostitutes, serial killers. Couldn't do that as a poet. It's not my voice, you know, but I can do it as a fiction writer, and that's...
Well, and that's what you're both doing, and you've both chosen a range of voices and backgrounds and styles. And Maxine, at the beginning of your book, you have a quote from Chinua Achebe about language and language transformed by other cultures, and it really helped me think about both of your books. But how do you go about, as writers, how do you go about imagining yourself into these other voices and cultures? And because it's also about a different use of English, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The quote in the cover of the book, Chinua Achebe quote, "Let no one be fooled by the fact that we may write in English, for we intend to do unheard of things with it." And I guess I'm interested in this thing of, you know, when you read a lot of writing, everybody sounds the same. And I don't necessarily mean that their language is the same. I mean, the rhythms, the way that they speak to each other. When you speak to someone in real life, everybody has a really different way of talking, whether it's to do with the inflection, where they came from, where they grew up, where they've been educated. And so for me, one of the key things is when you're writing, particularly in first person, but not only in first person, is to get that right, you know, that if this is this person's voice, it needs to, the actual vernacular needs to tell you something about this person.
At the Sydney Writers' Festival and on RN's Books and Arts, I'm Kate Evans and you're with writers Maxine Benaba-Clark and Ali Alizadeh. Now, we've been a little polite so far, and Ali, despite the very even tone of your reading, your work bristles. More than that, it strikes me as full of rage. Is that what drives your writing?
I guess. I mean, that's probably a fair thing to say, but... I'm also interested in the sort of aesthetics of, I mean, I'm into aesthetics theory, that's something I teach and do, and one of the points I like, you know, what is art, what does it do, you know, and I actually tend to think that art makes people think. That's hence Plato's problem with art, because philosophy should make people think, art competes with philosophy, therefore it should be exiled from the Republic. And I tend to think, well, how do we make people think? And there's an idea of a negative aesthetics, things that negate what people think. I think that has to be a level of offensiveness or provocation built into it. I'm not sure how angry I am personally. I am angry. I'm very angry about, you know, objectification of women in pornography and so on. But my primary aim, I think, is to make people feel uncomfortable as readers, because that to me is the task of art. Otherwise, Plato would have no problem with artists. If artists were simply producing nice, entertaining, cathartic simulacra, then he would leave them in the Republic. But if they can make people think, and I think this kind of negation, offence, rage, some of it is personal, but I think some of it is the effect I'm trying to produce.
And what about you, Maxine? Are you writing into anger?
I think maybe writing into sadness rather than writing into anger. I mean, I am angry, you know, about things that are going on politically. But I guess for me, the characters always come first. So it's not necessarily kind of I'm really angry about this thing that's happening, I'm going to write a story about it. It's kind of, okay, well, you know, I've seen that still of this young black kid on CCTV smashing into a shop window. How did he get there? You know, and that curiosity of we just get this sound bite. You know, a lot of my stories deal with things that are actually going on kind of in contemporary around me. And just that thing of kind of, as human beings, that curiosity of, no, these aren't just kids smashing the street. There are all of these other things going on and there are all of these stories there that we're not hearing.
But Ali, most of your anger and vengeance and violence is played out in this book on women's bodies, whether in reality or as a sort of fantasy revenge. Why?
Well, I disagree. There's a lot of men who come to very sticky ends as well. The central character, the central killer, who's the most autobiographical character in the book, actually? She's a serial killer. I don't define her identity or history. I'm not even sure where she's from or who she might be, but she's the one who kills quite a few people.
I still think there's an awful lot of sexual violence against women, which you're saying is a critique, but as a reader can mean you're reading an awful lot of sexual violence against women. And so I think you need to talk about that.
Well, okay. Well, no, there are a number of issues. I mean, no, there are men who get killed as well in this book. There are quite a few of them. I can name them as well.
Oh, yeah, no. The
asylum seeker, for example, the Iranian asylum seeker that I read, he gets... In fact, one of the other stories is this slow hanging and suffocation of him as he runs out of breath, as he narrates his own death in the hands of the female killer. There are men who get murdered as well.
Well, you know, I'm not saying they're not, but I'm interested in the way that revenge fantasies and so on are all happening on women's bodies.
That's precisely revenge fantasy. So the man who gets hanged is being killed as a revenge for what he did in his past.
But are you doing this just to be provocative?
No, I'm just answering your question. But you've got a point. No, I mean the point is, okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing is that there is a lot of violence that is being done on the bodies of people and of women all over the world.
Well, Maxine, you write about violence as well, and it's there quite explicitly in your book. How do you approach writing violence?
I think writing violence is a very difficult thing to do. And a lot of the violence in foreign soil, I guess, is written in a way that it's not explicit. You know, in the first story, there's a section of it that's set in Sudan and there's a civil war going on and there's a child that dies in the story. But you kind of almost don't know that he's dying. You get this kind of image of him, you know, there's you get this image of this kind of red fire, you know, which is actually his blood, and this kind of dark patches on the soil. And I think it's because violence is, it's almost more violent not to describe the way something's happening. You know, in the story Foreign Soil, which is the title story, you have this woman who's stuck in a foreign country in this kind of domestic violence situation. And there is an act of domestic violence that happens, but throughout most of the story, it's this kind of just foreboding that something is not quite right. You can't quite figure out what it is. And I feel like that is almost more, the point at which the violence actually happens is almost less significant than that kind of strange mind play that goes on beforehand. So I tend to write violence and then underwrite it and pare it back and take out anything that's really explicit or that doesn't need to be there.
Because you've both used violence in the same way that you've both used different voices, but the effect is quite different. I mean, your styles of writing are quite different, and I wondered if you actually had any questions for each other about the choices that you're making. And if that's putting you on the spot, I can quickly move along.
I guess my question to Ali was similar to the one that you were talking about, whether there is a responsibility when you're writing about violence as a writer, or you're writing something that's quite confronting, to ensure that the reader knows why you're doing it. And that can be a really difficult thing to do. But, you know, when you read a book that is kind of so explicitly violent, as a reader, if you don't know the theory behind it...
But you see, Max, you know, I think that extra knowledge, that supplement, would completely limit and destroy the artness of my art. This is not a manifesto of how PC I am. In real life, actually, my friends call me, you know, a male feminist and make fun of it. this is not about how good and ethical I am. This has to work as a level of art, precisely if it doesn't have that additional supplementary knowledge, which tells people, oh, you're in safe hands. No, this dude is really a feminist. He's just critiquing violence against women. No, I'm not. As a matter of fact, I'm not. As a matter of fact, if for this work to work properly, it must not have that license attached to it.
Do you have any responses to that, Maxine?
No, I guess I just find it interesting. You know, I just wanted to know whether you feel like there is any kind of obligation as a writer to ensure that this isn't just another thing that is putting those images out there, or to ensure, you know.
Maxine, I think the images are out there. I don't think anybody who's going to read a literary work published by me is likely to not be aware of the fact that these images are well and truly out there.
Now, Maxine, your stories of migrant communities and people whose lives have been haunted by the past, they are enormously powerful. But there's a whole other level of sort of visceral pain when you write into the refugee experience. What are you doing with those stories?
I guess trying to... I feel like they're stories that aren't told. You know, we get, again, these kind of sound bites of this is something that is on our news and in our newspapers daily. But because the situation is such that it is, the actual reality of, you know, we think of, oh, it's awful, we're locking people up in detention centres. What does it mean to be locked in a room for 24 hours a day for 4 or 5 years? And what does that mean in terms of your day-to-day? So in that particular story, I broke down the story with a clock. So every few paragraphs, a few sentences, you get a timestamp of, you know, this person's brushed their teeth and this person's now put their pyjamas on and this person's because of that kind of slowing down of time. So I guess it's really trying to get a sense and allow people to experience and perhaps maybe understand a bit more what people might have gone through. Yeah.
Ali, can I ask you about another character who's very powerful in your book, and she's an avenging angel. Mm-hmm. What's going on here?
So she's the avenging, and I really love her. I mean, I think there's a lot of me in her, but... So, you know, one of the things, and I think this came up before, about this question of identity and you know, some Maxine knows brilliantly. I mean, it's very believable, and when we read her express ideas of identity and you know, particularity. But in this book, which is also about identity and culture and religion and nationality in particular, I found that if there's going to be an avenging angel who's going to do all of this right, it will be someone without an identity.
But explain what's going on for people who haven't read it.
She could be anyone. She's a chameleon. But the only thing we know about her is her necklace. So that's the recurring motif, which is it's a lapis lazuli phoenix necklace. I have a theory of who she might be, and based on that theory, I think that she... You know, there was this... I shouldn't be saying this, but there's this great Afghan feminist socialist that I've dedicated the book to, Mina Keshwar Kamal, and she was against the Soviets, but she was also against the Islamists. She was murdered in the 80s, I believe, by the agents of the CIA, but the Americans said Soviets did it, but you know, probably ultimately doesn't matter. She was strangled. I thought, what would it look like if her daughter came back to have revenge? So I have a very... I have a sense that it might be, in fact, her daughter, but she has to be a void. She can't really be that person. So she changes accents, changes appearance, changes complexion, age and so on, every time she meets a new potential victim. And she's a really great character. I think I might stick to her and I might write another book where she goes around and kills more people.
So she's a shapeshifter, this character. Yeah. She turns up and confronts people across a whole range of countries who have done terrible things. Mm. Do you need an avenging angel, Maxine?
I am the avenging angel.
And that is, of course, the perfect answer. Now, there's a question down the front here.
You're both, the word that I use is sort of diasporan, right? So you're from somewhere else and but raised in Australia. Do you think that's affected the fact that you have a desire to tell international stories, that you're not necessarily located and fixed here, that you can, you've got an interest in how we globally interlink in a way?
Quite possibly. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I'm not quite conscious of it. This comes to me very naturally. But a part of me is concerned. I mean, you know, the number of years that I did grow up in Iran and the little I know about elsewhere, and people write books that are set in other countries. People write stories very freely without a feeling that they're betraying the cultural heritage. Whereas here, you've got to have, it's got to be set in Australia. We've got to have gum trees and horses. I've been here for over 20 years, so I'm sufficiently Australianized, but I'm not sure. There is probably an implicit, it's another level of rage probably, but why not? Why can't I write about a, you know, somebody in Amsterdam or in your Liberia, and for the book to be published here? Everybody else is doing it all over the world, but Australians are not doing it as much.
Yeah, I would agree with Ali. I mean, I think that definitely, I mean, I'm Australian born and I've lived most of my life here, almost all of my life here. But, you know, I do feel like having that diaspora background, those stories are closer to my life. You know, I know people who have kind of been through similar experiences, or, you know, I think there is a grain of me in each story. But yeah, at the same time, I feel like as an Australian writer, you are expected to set your book in Australia. You know, it's easier to market, you know, people can recognise themselves in it. There's this perception that people want to either read literature that reflects who they are and their experience, or want escapist literature. You know, they want to kind of read a book and be taken away and have a lovely time, and hopefully it's all one big romantic comedy or something.
Look, at the Sydney Writers Festival and on RN's Books and Arts, I'm Kate Evans, and you've been with writers Maxine Benaba-Clark, whose latest book is Foreign Soil, and Ali Alizada, whose latest book is Transactions. Please do thank them both. Maxine Benaba-Clark and Ali Alizada, with me at the Sydney Writers Festival.